We're talking about the coronavirus economy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump announced a package of coronavirus relief measures over the weekend in response to a deadlocked Congress. Meanwhile, the National Governors Association has been expressing doubt in a statement Monday about carrying out a new $400 unemployment supplement. Wisconsin is still working to clear a backlog of unemployment claims that may not be resolved until later in the fall. What concerns you most about the economy? What was your reaction to President Trump's executive orders? We're at 800-642-1234. Heather Long is an economic correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be here.
Well, let's start with these executive orders over the weekend. Tell us what these orders are attempting to do.
President Trump obviously was frustrated with the inability of Congress to come to any sort of deal right now. And so he said, look, I'm going to take action on my own. And what he did four different, he called them executive orders. Actually, only one is an executive order. The other three are memorandums, which are slightly, you know, a little bit more dialed down. The thing that he really gave relief, legitimate relief on, is student debt. So for people who owe student loan payments, they do not have to make those through the end of the year. And he actually canceled the interest through the end of the year on those payments. So that's a legitimate savings, you know, of several hundred dollars for a lot of people a month. The other things he did, he claimed that he stopped evictions. You know, we've seen these horrible pictures of people's stuff being thrown out on the curb in the middle of a pandemic. So he said that he has stopped that. He reiterated that again yesterday. In reality, if you read the executive order he did on housing, he just asks the Housing and Urban Development Secretary and some of his other secretaries to, quote, consider whether we should ban evictions. So he does not actually ban evictions. Evictions can still continue based on what he did this weekend. The last thing that he did, the last two things that you were just talking about, unemployment. So on unemployment, he said, oh, look, you know, I'm going to extend that federal money, that extra bonus or enhancement, as some people call it. It was at $600 through the end of July. And he said, I'm going to extend it through by $400. This one has gotten a ton of blowback. You know, is it legal for a president to distribute money? That power is supposed to rest with Congress. So there's legal questions around that. And the bigger question that you've seen from a number of these governors who've pushed back and said, look, you know, you're asking us to, you're saying it's a $400 extension, but you're asking states to put in $100 and the federal government would put in $300. Many states are already cash strapped. They don't have the money. The final point real quick is on the payroll tax. He sort of portrayed, hey, I'm going to do a payroll tax cut from September 1st through the end of the year. Again, if you actually read what he did in the memo, he didn't give a cut. He gave a tax, what I'd call holiday or vacation or postponement. So what that means is employees don't have to pay their payroll tax for Social Security for those 4 months, but the bill would still be due in 2021. So it's sort of like a hat trick. You don't have to pay it for a while, but boom, you're going to get that bill in 2021.
When you do, it will all add up and to a lot more because it's been delayed. What is the likelihood that these measures will be challenged?
It seems pretty high. I mean, the basic challenge is constitutional. You know, the power of the purse rests with Congress, and the president has tried to reallocate money, if you're being kind. So he took some money from the hurricane, the disaster relief fund, to try to move it to unemployment. So that's a little bit questionable, you know, but he's also trying, some people would argue that power should only be with Congress. The bigger issue, though, I think about where these could be challenged, and you're already seeing pushback, including from Republican governors, is this question of, is it even feasible? You know, it makes it sound like, oh, we're just extending this unemployment money. Actually, on the back end, what's happening is this program that President Trump would put in place is entirely different from the one that was in place for the last several months under the CARES Act. And so, you know, it sounds very bureaucratic if you're on the, you know, obviously everyone just wants to get money to people who desperately need it right now. But a lot of states are saying, look, the reality is it would take us weeks to put this together.
So this extension would be new federal spending, something distinctly different than what the previous $600 program was.
You said it better than me. It is distinctly different. However, it is not, the new money is a little bit, it gets hazy. So again, this money was allocated by Congress for the FEMA disaster relief. So for hurricanes and tornadoes and bushfires and that sort of thing, President Trump is arguing, hey, we're in the middle of a pandemic. That's a pretty big disaster. Can I just take some of that money that would have gone to hurricane relief and move it over here and put it for unemployment benefits? Unfortunately, he's only allotting $44 billion. That might sound like a lot. Sure sounds like a lot to me, but that would probably be gone in about a month. So again, not a lot of money that's moving around.
Talking with Heather Long, she is an economic correspondent for The Washington Post. We're looking at the economic issues amid the pandemic. Taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Heather, you reported recently that unless Congress passes another stimulus bill soon, that the damage to the economy could be permanent. What do you mean by this?
Yeah, you sort of think, oh, well, it doesn't really matter if they act now or maybe after the election. But I spend a lot of my day calling and talking to unemployed folks and especially talking to small business owners. And what I hear a lot from small business owners is obviously huge blow to them in the spring. You know, they basically had no money coming in. Think about hair salons or restaurants or your favorite corner store. And, you know, they sort of, you know, barely eked by in that period. They reopened in June. And what we've seen in the economy is sort of a flatlining in July. So I hear from a lot of people, you know, I'm still down 50%. So I was on the phone with a hotel, small boutique hotel in Key West, Florida. And she said, you know, we're 55% back. I'm basically some weeks I break even, some weeks I don't. And what this means is the longer that people limp along like this, the more likely those businesses are to shut forever and just throw their hands up and say, I can't do this. I'm barely breaking even. I don't want to go into debt again. And I'm just going to shut. You know, I'm going to die.
Well, last month, the country added 1.8 million jobs, the third month of gains in the number of jobs. Why are economists still so concerned about about what's going on?
Well, part of it is, you know, those small businesses close, those jobs go away. I think, too, you know, you're right. It was pretty encouraging to see, and that makes a huge difference for those 1.8 million people who did get a job back and for their families. But the other way, and unfortunately, the glass half empty side of this is about 60% of the jobs that were lost in April and March are not back yet. So the good news is we've recovered 42%. The bad news is 58% of them are not back. And what we're seeing is a slowing in the job growth. So we saw a ton of job growth in May and June, but that pace has slowed down. So the June pace was about double the July pace. So, you know, we would have to keep going at the July pace every month for the next several months in order to get all those jobs back. That looks more and more unrealistic. If you just look at, you know, any sort of data tracker, whether it's how much gas people are getting buying at the pump right now or how many restaurant reservations people are making again. All of that indicates the economy is stalling.
We have the Washington Post economics correspondent Heather Long as our guide to the economy. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the state of the economy? Are you unemployed? Are you cutting back on spending? How have you managed to adjust in these difficult times? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Heather Long here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we check in on economic policies and the strength of the dollar. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, told NBC News in an interview that aired yesterday that there's going to be some scar tissue from this recession. But
we're going to have to open up. It could be done safely and soundly. You've seen it being done in countries around the world. You know, we've made a few mistakes in certain parts of this country, but opening up will be okay. You can go back to work safe and sound, and so that hopefully the economy will have a chance to recover.
What worries you about the economy reopening? We're at 800-642-1234. We have the Washington Post's Heather Long, who covers the economy. She stays with us. Heather, we heard there from Jamie Dimon, and the sentiment seemed to indicate that, you know, everything's going to be okay. There will be some pain, but, you know, the world's most powerful companies have things under control. What do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting. He had made also a comment to CNN. You played an NBC clip where he was sounding a lot more pessimistic, particularly about the fate of small businesses. So I think, you know, look, the main thing is the economy has recovered a little bit. Like we were talking about, 40% of those jobs are back. You know, most places have been able to reopen. But the reality is you still have, just look at most of the restaurants and bars in your area, possibly some small retailers, you know, go and talk to those folks. The message that I overwhelmingly hear is I'm open, but I'm certainly not back. I'm far from normal. And that's, you know, that's the gray area that we're all trying to navigate. And that's what you can see in the economic data. We're not fully back yet. You know, is this going to take us a year to recover, or is this going to take us 5 years to recover?
Let's bring in Dave now, who's joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to know if President Trump is so concerned about the unemployed and doing something about it, couldn't he just reallocate some of his money for the wall and help fund that unemployment benefits?
So moving money away from building the wall and moving that money around. Heather?
Well, he's basically tried to do the same thing that he did for the wall, which is to reallocate money. It's just this time, instead of taking it from the same place that he used to go for the wall funding, this time he's gone and raided the fund for hurricanes and tornadoes, the disaster relief fund. It's interesting you bring up the wall. You know, the wall funding is less. Right now he's taking $44 billion to try to move that for unemployment benefits. That should last about a month of payments. For the wall, initially he only took, I believe, around $2 billion. So it is a much bigger scale here that we're talking about. We do have 30 million people in this country who are currently receiving unemployment benefits.
Let's bring in David now, joining us from Boscobel this morning. Hi, David.
Hi. I have a comment and then a question for your guest. I mean, the guest is lamenting that these small businesses aren't back. They're going to go under. And it seems to be laid at the foot of the federal government or the president. And my question is, you know, a lot of governors in various states have put restrictions on how many people can be in a restaurant at a time, how many people can be in a store. And, you know, how are these businesses going to get back if these states continue to keep these restrictions on these small businesses? And how is the federal government responsible for that and supposed to deal with that?
David, thanks. Heather?
Yeah, it's a great point. I certainly hear that a lot. I think overwhelmingly what I hear from small business owners is they just want clear rules. So for instance, I'm not as familiar with Wisconsin, but like in Kentucky, when the bars first opened and restaurants, they were allowed to open at 50%. Then that was scaled back to 25. And so I think, you know, every governor's trying to navigate the situation in their state. My home state of Pennsylvania has like a whole checkerboard. You know, some parts of the state are open more than others. And so what I just hear from small business is just tell me what the rules are and then I can adjust. And I think there's a feeling both that the state and the federal government have not provided clear enough guidelines. In terms of what the federal government can do, The federal government has a lot more, has the power to borrow money and allocate it across the country. So the federal government can play the role of putting money out into the economy in a way that state and local governments can't. And what you're hearing right now from a lot of both small and big business leaders, like Jamie Dimon, who was played earlier, the clip from him, is this, why aren't we doing another round of aid for small businesses? And I think that's really a big role the federal government can play that other governments can't.
We're talking with Heather Long, is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. You can join in. What concerns you about the economy? What do you want to know about the latest economic indicators? It's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Russ now, joining us from Pleasant Springs. Hi, Russ.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask the guest, I haven't heard it mentioned in the president's new stimulus package. Are there going to be additional $1,200 payouts per person in the country?
Yeah, great, great question. So good news and bad news on that front. The good news is that is one of the few areas that Republicans and Democrats in Congress do agree on. So they've come in these talks they've been having that both sides would like to do another round of those checks, which would probably go out, let's say, September, October. The bad news is they haven't reached an agreement on everything else on a number of other fronts. So there is no deal right now. So those checks are not coming until they actually pass it. President Trump cannot do another round of stimulus checks on his own. That does need to come from Congress.
Russ, thanks for the question. Heather, I want to ask you about the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, Neil Kashkari. He turned heads recently when he said the answer would be to mandated lockdowns in every state for up to 6 weeks in an effort to allow public health to work. And he feels like he said we threw the towel in too early before health officials had actually gotten control of the virus. What do you think? And now here, you know, across the border in Wisconsin, I don't know if Neil Kashkari's idea of another lockdown would go anywhere. But what do you make of that?
Well, I think a lot of people looked at his comments and thought he's speaking about the failure at both the state and the federal level in the United States to do that in the spring. You know, we all thought that that's what we were doing. I certainly did. My husband and I, when we were staying home for most of March and April and a good bit of May, I think everybody thought that was what we were doing. We were giving hospitals the time to flatten the curve, giving public health officials and governors and the president time to sort this out and come up with a plan. Unfortunately, it's evident the United States didn't come up with as good of a plan as most other advanced nations across the world. You know, you look at Germany or Japan, these countries are able to reopen their schools. They're able to have business more mostly back to normal, and the United States still is not. So I don't know. It's so controversial to close down again. Again, as I call around to small business owners, the number one thing they say to me is, I wish the rules were clearer. I wish the guidelines were clear. And the number two thing they say is, I just hope and pray we don't shut down again. So I hear that. I hear that tension. I think what I've, the best, a hair salon owner said this to me this week. She said, you know, if you told me we were going to do one more shutdown for 2 or 3 weeks and it was going to solve most of the problems, I would do it. It would be hard, but I would do it. But if I cannot go through another open-ended, you know, it could be 2 months, it could be 3 months. And so that's where I respect Neil Kashkari, you know, saying, what if we just shut down again for a few weeks? The big fear is a few weeks enough?
Yeah. Let's bring in Jim now in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi, just sort of a remark, I guess. I think we're facing a global monetary collapse. There's unprecedented debt at virtually all levels. If a debt can't be paid back, it won't be paid back. And I think much of what we're seeing with this hysteria over this flu epidemic is a distraction, and we're facing much worse things in the relatively near future than anything we've experienced.
Jim, thanks. Heather, are we headed toward a major economic collapse due to the debt we're getting ourselves into?
I'm not normally a pessimist, but the caller makes a very good point. You know, at the moment, not just the United States, but across the world, countries are taking on vast amounts of debt. The United States is a good example. We're about in the coming years will be more debt as a percentage of our economy than we had even during World War II. So this is pretty alarming. Also, companies are taking on more debt. So both small businesses are trying to stay afloat. Large companies are taking on historic amounts of debt. It was already high and alarming before the pandemic. Now it's gotten worse. And you're right. You put all this together and it's a scary picture, because at some point those bills do come due. And while a lot of people are getting a grace period in the middle of a pandemic, that, you know, what about 5 years, 10 years down the road? And so I agree. And that's the big danger of what's happening now. Nobody quite knows where it's all going to end up.
Heather, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Heather Long is an economic correspondent for The Washington Post. Coming up, we talk with WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the results of yesterday's primary election. And that recap is coming after this news update here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin voters went to the polls or voted absentee in droves for the fall partisan primary election yesterday. We have takeaways. We have a recap here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The races included primaries for U.S. House seats, state assembly seats, and even-numbered state Senate seats. This was our second statewide election since the start of the pandemic. Did you vote? How did you participate in the primary? What was voting like where you were? Join in 800-642-1234. Sean Johnson is WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. He's also co-host of the WPR Politics podcast and Derailed. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, Kate.
Well, before we dig into yesterday's results, let's touch base on Joe Biden announcing Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate. Did you hear anything out of that news yesterday in Wisconsin?
I think what you heard yesterday in Wisconsin kind of mirrored what you heard at the national level. Democrats on the same page, Republicans too. You just look at Wisconsin's political leaders. Tammy Baldwin, who, by the way, was on a lot of short at least 10 candidate lists for vice president. She said Kamala is an inspiring and historic choice. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes said she's no stranger to breaking through barriers and has never backed down from a challenge. Congresswoman Gwen Moore called it a historic moment, said Kamala is more than ready for the job. And on the other side of things, state GOP chair Andrew Hitt criticized Harris's far left agenda. He said he called her an extremist pushing socialist policies. So I think what you heard here is very similar to what you heard nationally when it came to that announcement.
Well, we learned Joe Biden not coming to Milwaukee for the DNC. That would extend to Harris as well, not making an appearance in Milwaukee.
As far as I know, there are no national figures coming to Milwaukee. And, you know, from what we know now, it looks like featured speakers will include, you know, Governor Tony Evers, Baldwin, Mayor Tom Barrett. So local Wisconsinites speaking at the convention, whatever that's going to look like. And then there will be a virtual aspect to it. But, you know, virtual is not in Wisconsin, of course.
And DNC organizers asked people attending to sign a pledge agreeing not to go to bars or restaurants in Milwaukee. What is that about?
Yeah, this was first reported by our colleague Corey Hess, and a Democratic National Convention Committee spokesperson said convention participants were asked to avoid bars, restaurants, and other locations. Corey got a screenshot of the pledge, and it just says avoid bars and restaurants. I think this is a step, obviously, that they're taking in an effort to prevent the spread of COVID-19. It is kind of amazing, though, that in this same year, I mean, I remember back in February talking about a bill at the state capitol that would extend bar hours during the week of the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee. And now here we are with the remaining attendees being asked to avoid bars altogether.
How times have changed, right? Well, let's look at yesterday's election. We have interviewed in recent weeks here several of the congressional candidates leading up to yesterday's primary. And in the first congressional district seat, Democrats Josh Pate and Roger Pollack campaigned to face Republican U.S. Representative Brian Steil in November. Tell us about that outcome.
Roger Pollack won that race with about 58% of the vote to Josh Pate's 42%. You might remember Josh Pate is one of the candidates who ran for governor in that crowded primary a couple of years ago. So Roger Pollack will take on Brian Steil in November. This will be Steil's second general election in that race, which is Paul Ryan's old district. And I think any of these races, you could say that about any of these congressional races, especially what they look like in November will kind of depend on what the country looks like in November, what the race for president looks like in November and what we're talking about. But if you just want to look to 2018 as kind of a benchmark for how this district goes, Steil won this district with 55% of the vote in 2018.
Moving over to the 4th Congressional District, Republicans Tim Rogers and Cindy Werner ran face-to-face, and they will be facing Democratic U.S. Representative Gwen Moore. Who won between Tim Rogers and Cindy Werner?
So as of right now, just looking at the election results from AP, it's very close. I mean, they didn't declare a winner in the way that they did other races. Rogers was up 50.3% to, 49.7% for Werner in that district. So based on those totals, it would be Tim Rogers. Of course, in that district, the fourth district, it's essentially a contest for, practically speaking, for who's going to go on to lose in the general election. It's a highly Democratic congressional district against a longtime incumbent in Gwen Moore. But it's looking like Rogers will emerge from the GOP primary there.
Well, speaking of returns, what did you see out of the timing of returns coming in? Because so much of the vote was absentee.
It was a long delay for counting absentee ballots in Milwaukee, and I'm not entirely clear on why that is. But I guess if you're talking about the mechanics of the election, that is something that kind of stuck out yesterday. Otherwise, it's different, certainly, than the election that we talked about in April, especially in a couple of the cities that got a lot of the attention in April. In Milwaukee, the city had 5 polling places open in April, due partly to a decision on what they felt was safe. They chose large, airy polling places based on what we kind of knew about the coronavirus at the time, but also due to a lack of poll workers. Yesterday, they had 168 polling places, so obviously a lot more than 5 in Milwaukee. And in Green Bay, another city that had long lines in April, they had 2 polling places open. They had 17 open yesterday. And so you didn't hear the long lines that you saw in April.
Moving to the House District 6 seat, Glenn Grothman there for November. What did you see out of Democrats Jessica King, Michael Beardsley, and Matthew Boer?
Jessica King won that district pretty handily, won the primary, that is, with 75% of the vote. So she will go on to face Glenn Grothman in November. Jessica King is a former state senator. And then again, that in that district, just to give a sense of the leanings of the district, Grothman won that district with 55% of the vote in 2018, which was, a decent Democratic year.
We're talking with WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about yesterday's partisan primary election. Getting your take as well at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jim now in Freedom. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
I live in Jim Steinke's legislative district, and I ordered an absentee ballot, and I'll be honest with you, I cut the stamp off and used it to pay my electric bill because there was nobody running against anybody on either one of the primary, the two major parties' tickets. So it's just a waste of taxpayers' money to even have that primary because it was just Robert Cowles, Mike Gallagher, and Jim Steinke on a Republican ticket, and then there was one person on each of those same positions on a Democratic ticket. So it was just a total waste of taxpayers' money. Thank you.
Yeah, Jim, thank you. Uncontested races. Did you see that across this election?
Well, I mean, it definitely depended on where you were. Mm-hmm. You know, here in Madison, we definitely had some contested races, very big, big competitive primaries. So it is one of those things where it as it is with any election, it depends where you are. And those are some races that, you know, the caller just mentioned where the parties decided, OK, we know who our candidates are, and they didn't have primaries, or they just decided it wasn't worth the risk to run somebody else. Elsewhere, it was a different story.
Are there any races right now that are still too close to call? You mentioned one there, but are there others?
That, you know, that's one of the ones that.
And I think we're losing you there. Sean, can you still hear us? We've been talking with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about yesterday's partisan primary, the results, as we saw a major influx of absentee ballots, absentee voters who voted via absentee mail-in voting for yesterday's partisan primary. You can join in with your insights on how yesterday went at 800-642-1234. Sean, are you still there?
I am. Sorry, okay. Did we lose?
We lost connection there for a moment. I want to move into Green Bay here and switch to the state Senate. Democratic State Senator Dave Hansen is retiring. What made this particular election to replace him an interesting one to watch?
So Hansen's district is one of a handful that come November will be watching more closely, I think. So the primaries sort of flew under the radar, but this is a district where Dave Hansen has held it since 2000. He's a Democrat, but it is a district that went to Donald Trump, and it is a district where other Republicans have performed well over the past couple decades. But Dave Hansen has won, so he's retiring. What's that going to mean for his district? And this is an important question because, you know, Republicans are vying for a two-thirds majority or a veto-proof supermajority in the legislature that would let them override vetoes by Governor Tony Evers. To do that, they'd essentially have to flip three seats. So this is one of them they'll be looking at. And Hansen's nephew actually won there. Jonathan Hansen, he's going to go on to face Eric Wimberger of Green Bay in November.
We are in a partisan primary recap with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. What questions do you have about yesterday's election? Do you vote in a Democratic or Republican primary? How do you feel about the results? What about those uncontested races? What do you think? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Sean Johnson here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our partisan primary recap with WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Absentee voting numbers were high, with more than 900,000 ballots requested by voters looking to avoid in-person at the polls. National Guard helped staff polling sites and filled gaps identified by local clerks. Sean, taking a look at the state Senate seat to replace Democratic Senator Fred Risser in Madison, that was a big pool of candidates. Who prevailed?
Kelda Royce prevailed in that seven-candidate Democratic primary. So she had 40% of the vote in that race. The next nearest challenger had 27%. So and that was Nada Elma Kashfi, who came in second in that race. So Kelda Royce, who is a former state representative, ran for Congress in 2012 against Mark Pocan, ran for governor in 2018 and came in third, came in first in the state Senate primary last night for downtown Madison. And so she is going to go on to replace Fred Risser in the state Senate. And Fred Risser has held that seat for 58 years. So that is kind of a big deal, especially in Madison politics.
Well, let's look at the vacant state Senate district seat in La Crosse that was previously held by Democratic Senator Jennifer Schilling. What did you see there?
This is another one of those that I think kind of flying under the radar now, but we'll be paying more attention in the fall. It's one of those seats that could determine control of the legislature. Brad Half, the former secretary of the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, won his primary. He's going to face former state senator Dan Kopanky, who lost twice to Schilling. And this is one of those where Republicans are hoping that they can flip the seat. But Half has pretty deep roots in that district and kind of hit the ground running in this race. So, I mean, that'll be one that you'll be paying attention to. A lot of money, I expect, will be spent there.
With the number of retirements or members seeking other offices, how different will the state Senate look next year?
It will, I think it's going to look a lot different. Yeah. I mean, because it's not just Fred Risser, who has been an institution at the Capitol. You had, State Senator Mark Miller of Monona also retiring, and State Representative Melissa Sargent won the Democratic primary in that seat. She'll have a challenger this fall, but she'll be the heavy favorite in that seat. We mentioned Schilling, we mentioned Hansen. Dave Craig, a Republican in conservative Southeast Wisconsin, also stepping down, and Julian Bradley of Franklin won his five-way GOP primary there. So there's going to be a lot of new faces in the state Senate, and there's likely going to be a new majority leader too.
I was going to ask, who would replace Scott Fitzgerald if he wins his bid for Congress?
I think that's kind of an open question right now. I mean, the last I knew, there were a few candidates potentially interested in that position. They're not really openly campaigning for it because, Fitzgerald is still there. He's still the majority leader. He hasn't won his he just won his primary last night in his race for Congress. I'm certain that the campaigning is happening right now, kind of behind the scenes and internally within that GOP caucus. We should know this winter, I guess, who's going to be the next majority leader, assuming Republicans keep the Senate and Fitzgerald goes on to Congress.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the results of yesterday's partisan primary. You can join in with your insights, your questions about races, 800-642-1234. Sean, in April, we saw those long lines at the polls in Milwaukee, Green Bay. As you mentioned, the governor called the National Guard in to help staff polling places this time around. How did that go? Have you heard of any reports of long lines yesterday?
I mean, I think I can't say it definitively there were none, but I kind of think it's a situation where no news is good news in a way, because certainly in the places where we saw lines last time around, there weren't. There were National Guard there to help staff the polling places. One could presume, it's not certainly not official yet, but that will happen again in November. I think November is the race that we're going to watch to see kind of what April taught us. You know, April, yeah, we had those long lines. April was our first election where, we're speaking behind plexiglass shields and using sanitized pens and hand sanitizer at the door, all these steps that we've started taking to prevent spread of COVID-19. And in November, there's just going to be a lot more people voting. I mean, the August primary was kind of a test run a little bit, but the turnout's just so much higher for a November general election.
One other race I want to ask you about is with in Green Bay with Representative Stosh Grzynski. The Democratic incumbent representative lost his primary to a challenger. What did you see there?
Yeah, Green Bay school board member Christina Shelton won that race against Stosh Grzynski. This is in the 90th Assembly District. And this is significant because this is months after Grzynski sexually harassed a Capitol staffer. And Christina Shelton won with 79% of the vote yesterday. So that's a pretty big victory.
Yeah. Does she have a background in politics at all? Do we know anything about her?
I mean, she's a Green Bay school board member. And in this race, she was backed by the Assembly Democratic leadership and in a big way. I mean, they made it clear that they wanted to move on from Grzynski, spent money on her behalf. And so not only did she win against an incumbent, she won big.
Mm. You have been covering the rapper Kanye West's run for president, getting some attention here in Wisconsin. What is going on there?
So what's happening is that Kanye West filed to get on Wisconsin's presidential ballot it was last week. And so now we're in the process where Democrats are challenging his petitions. And this is potentially noteworthy for November because Kanye West has very recently been a Donald Trump supporter. He said that he would run for president as a Republican if Donald Trump were not on the ballot. And he has said that he realizes his candidacy will pull some black votes away from Joe Biden. So if you're wondering why the parties are fighting over Kanye West being on the ballot when he's officially running on as an independent, that's kind of what's at play here. So Kanye West turned in his signatures last Tuesday. The deadline to turn those signatures in is 5 p.m. On Tuesday, the 4th. Democrats are saying he missed that deadline. You know, there's video showing him turning his lawyer, a Republican lawyer, turning those signatures in after the 5 o'clock sharp hour. Kanye West's campaign is saying if they were turned in at 5:14, which is their argument that they were turned in 14 seconds after the hour, that should count. They're saying that that should count as 5 o'clock. And so that is now before the Elections Commission to decide whether Kanye West gets on the ballot. I think it's more than just a question of whether a celebrity gets on the ballot in this case. It could have repercussions if Wisconsin is close as it was in 2016 when Donald Trump won the state by fewer than 23,000 votes.
Every vote counts, and they don't want to spin off any votes, either party, toward a Kanye West vote.
Well, I mean, I think there's no indication that Republicans have welcomed his candidacy there.
Okay.
They've said so in statements. They have an attorney working for his campaign. And so they've made the bet that a West candidacy peels votes away from Joe Biden, not from Donald Trump.
Sean, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Kate.
Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Just ahead, a former Black Army general who served for over 30 years joins us to discuss the issue of race in the military. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.